You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy President's Day. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And who do you think was the worst president in the history of America? In the history of America. I would put George W. Bush number one. And John Adams probably number two. He was a fine founder, but a lousy president. And or who do you think is the most obscure president? I would vote for Willard Fillmore in that category, but you know, we have some things to figure out here. There's a lot going on in the news that I want to share with you today. It's an extraordinary week. Greece right now. The Financial Times. Wolfgang Munchau writes regularly for the Financial Times. He's mostly an op-ed writer, very, very highly respected around the world. Commentator on these issues. And see, what the Greeks are experiencing right now is what people who live in the red states in the United States are experiencing right now. 24 of our states that are run by Republicans, Republican governors, Republican houses of representatives, have laid off in aggregate over 700,000 government workers since the election of 2008. And the result has been that in those 24 states, by and large, the level of economic activity, GDP, has gone down. Unemployment, the number of people out of work, has gone up. Gee, what a surprise. You lay off 700,000 people and unemployment goes up. who would have thought, right? Unemployment has gone up. And the budget deficits tend to get worse. And in some of these states, they've made it even worse by giving more tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires and things like that. So this is being played out in some of the red states in the United States. Yesterday or the day before yesterday, Saturday night, I keynoted a conference, a fundraiser for the DuPage Democratic Party in Chicago. And the speaker before me was the governor, Governor Pat Quinn. And thoroughly decent man and a good progressive. And, you know, he went through some very, very progressive policies and things and talked about them and, you know, what was going on. And then he pointed out that he had actually pushed through a tax increase in Illinois and that they were spending more money on a variety of things in Illinois. And as a consequence of that, they've seen their unemployment numbers go down, their employment go up. The state is on an upward spiral. It's not where he'd like it to be, but it's moving in the right direction. It's pretty impressive. But then it's a blue state. So I think it was really remarkable. But when you look at Greece, what's going on, and keep in mind, Greece only was able to join the EU because Goldman Sachs helped them, you know, put together a whole plan for them to basically lie about the state of their finances. Which they never should have done in the first place. They never should have gotten into bed with Goldman Sachs. They shouldn't have listened to the siren song. They shouldn't have taken the sales pitch. They should have said, no, not going to do it. No, thank you very much. We're going to stay here with the drachma. Because if Greece had stayed with the drachma, none of this would be happening right now. You're not hearing these kind of problems from Sweden. They've got the kroner. You're not hearing these kind of problems from Denmark or Norway. I mean, I believe all of those countries are using their own currency. You're not hearing that kind of problem, frankly, here in the United States, because not only do we have our own currency, the dollar, but it's the reserve currency of the world. So regardless of what Standard & Poor's says, we're still lending money at really, really cheap rates. I mean, people are buying our treasury bills at almost nothing. But in Greece, they cut their public health budget. In the year 2010, they cut it by 40%. This is a country with a national health care system and a very good one. And pretty soon, you know, over the next couple of years, you're going to see their hospitals start falling apart. And then the next step will be to privatize them. And I mean, everybody's sweeping in on them. They want the Greece's partners in the European Union. Want to force on them a 32% cut in the minimum wage. That would be like taking our minimum wage from $7 down to like, what, $4.50, $5? I mean, what is it now, $7.25, something like that? And they want a 22% cut in the minimum wage for people over 25. It's 32% for people 25 and under, 22% for people over 25, roughly a fifth. In the minimum wage, they want, you know, public sector workers fired. And what has happened as a result of this? I mean, you know, the Greeks have been doing a lot of this. What has happened as a result of this is that unemployment is skyrocketing. The economy is crashing. It's shrinking quarter after quarter. They're going deeper and deeper into a depression because they're following the economics of Paul Ryan and John Boehner. They're following the economics of Mitt Romney. Wow, clip number four. This is Mitt Romney basically saying he wants to do the same thing to America.
You have to look at people's records as well as their words. And I know that Senator Santorum is getting his moment in the spotlight now, which is a good thing. I hope people take a very close look at his record. If you want a fiscal conservative, you can't vote for Rick Santorum because he's not. He's not a deficit hawk. He says he's not a deficit hawk. I am. I'm a fiscal conservative. I'll balance the budget. I'll get America back on track economically.
Yeah, well, from the bank's point of view, perhaps, except actually the banks kind of like they are having a national debt, too, because they can invest in treasuries. But you balance the budget. Well, he didn't say he'd pay down our nation's debt. He said he'd balance the budget. So you're going to balance the budget with what? Are you going to raise taxes? That would balance the budget. Or are you going to cut more government workers like they've been doing in the red states and put us in the situation that Greece is in? I mean, this is one of the big issues of the day. We are seeing Jude Winiski's two Santa Claus theory played out writ large, not just in the United States, but all over the world. This is disaster capitalism. This is the destruction of sovereign nations. And it's a horrific thing. I mean, there's just no other way to describe it than the destruction of sovereign nations. So where do we go from here? And where does Greece go from here? Frankly, I think Greece should pull out of the EU, and I think that there's a very good chance that they will, but not before so much of the damage has already been done. But Germany doesn't want to pull out. You know, hey, pull out of the EU. It's by the way, did you know which country is doing the best in Europe right now? Poland. Poland has a very rapidly growing economy. It's strengthening, and their middle class evolving. And guess which country in all of Europe is spending the most money right now, public spending, to build roads, bridges, infrastructure, rebuild their nation? Poland. They're putting their country back. They're following the Truman-Eisenhower plan after World War II, when we rebuilt America, when we built America, the modern America, and built schools and highways and bridges and hospitals. And all these remarkable things. Okay, meanwhile, there's a delegation from Deutsche Telekom coming to the United States. So you say, Deutsche Telekom, what the heck is that? Deutsche Telekom is the German phone company. Used to be state-owned. And it is ironically, weirdly, interestingly, the major stockholder in T-Mobile here in the United States. Well, in Germany, Deutsche Telekom, the parent company, is entirely unionized, and their union members occupy 50% of the seats on the board of directors of Deutsche Telekom. It's a very union-friendly company where people are paid well, and not so much so here at T-Mobile in the United States. So they're coming to the United States to say to whoever will listen, frankly. Hey, you know, this union thing, it really works well. It's democracy in the workplace. It builds a strong middle class. It helps strengthen America.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Oh, and Montana got screwed on Friday. Got to tell you about that. And what's going on in Spain? Is this coming to the United States? Maybe Chicago in May. It's just incredible. Over the weekend, Tom Friedman wrote a piece in the Sunday Times talking about, you know, calling for a third party, saying, you know, if we end up basically with Santorum, you know, a weak and probably unelectable Republican candidate, then we need to have a third party to, quote, fill the space between the conservative Santorum or even Mitt Romney and the left of center Barack Obama. And then he talks, and then Tom Friedman talked about David Walker, the former controller of the currency, who is basically, you know, he's in it with the billionaires like Friedman, saying, oh, you know, it's all about the debt. It's all about the deficit. In other words, do to America what we did, what the EU and Goldman Sachs and the other banksters are doing and J.P. Morgan Chase and whatnot are doing to Greece. And they've created this thing called Americans Elect. They've already raised $22 million. It's a bunch of hedge fund managers on Wall Street. They've qualified their candidate now so far in 14 states, including California. They have 6,000 paid and volunteer canvassers. And they have 350,000 people on their mailing list who are going to vote for a candidate in the next few months. But here's the kicker. If the hedge fund billionaires who fund this thing don't like the candidate, like if everybody votes for Bernie Sanders, they get to ignore that and just appoint their own person, like, say, Mayor Bloomberg or Mitch Daniels or Chris Christie or whatever. As Robert Kuttner writes in his piece, The Radical Center We Don't Need, they call it Americans Elect, but it might as well be called Money Talks. And, you know, and he points out we already have a centrist party. It's called the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party, by and large, has been taking, I mean, the Democratic Party isn't calling for health care for all immediately, you know, as a national party. They're not calling to roll back Taft-Hartley. The things that I'm calling for, you know, the Democratic Party is fine, but they're only halfway there. It's why I want you, if you're listening or watching it, and you care about these things, to go to your local Democratic Party and say, I want to be a precinct committee person. I think I'd like to participate in that. So anyhow, some of your thoughts. Rhonda in Huntsville, Alabama. Hey, Rhonda, what's on your mind today?
Okay, I'm going to ask you this question, then I'm going to hang up and listen to you on the TV.
Okay. All righty.
Explain to me the Electoral College and why I should vote.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Rhonda. Why you should vote is because your vote matters. Elections have consequences. How the Electoral College works, when the founders were putting together the country and the Constitution and whatnot, one of the models that they looked at was the Iroquois Confederacy. And Thomas Jefferson was also looking at the old tribal Brits. This is before the year 300, when the Romans, 200 or 300, when the Romans invaded England. And those old histories of England before, when they were living tribally, are called the Whig histories. And Thomas Jefferson was very fond of them. The most famous is written by a man named Paul de Rapin de Taras. And the way that the Iroquois did it is they would elect, each community would elect a wise elder or a wise person who would then go to the annual meeting of everybody in the community to represent that community. And they were called sachems, those Indians who had did that. And in England, pre-Roman invasion and then the Norman invasion, the way that they did it was they had these meetings. They were called the Vikergemeinschaft. And again, each community would appoint a wise elder. And so their idea of the Electoral College was, because so many communities are so far away from Washington, D.C., and they may not know that much about the politics and the people running for office at the level of the presidency, this is only the presidency, that each community would elect the wise elder in their community who would then go to Washington, D.C. and make a choice. They would carry the decision of their community, but they wouldn't have to vote that decision. There have been a couple of cases in our history where electors have voted for somebody other than the person that they were elected to vote for. And the result of that is that, you know, you're actually voting for an Electoral College member. The Electoral College member basically transmits your vote for president, and very, very rarely in modern history deviates from that. My it was idealistic. It was a cool idea, you know. It was a very idealistic idea of having, you know, wise elders. This was back in the days before even the telegraph.
Right.
I don't think it's necessary in modern America. On the other hand, one of the things that the Electoral College does, because each state gets a number of electors equal to the number of elected officials they have. So Wyoming, for example, with 600,000 people, has three electors, two senators and a member of the House of Representatives. So they have three electoral votes. The same with Vermont. Many, the smaller states, you know, they have a couple of electoral votes. Whereas if you simply did it based on population, I was in DuPage County, Illinois, the day before yesterday, and I think, well, actually, I don't know the county. Somebody was talking about, you know, there's 5 million people here. I don't know if they were talking about Cook County. I think they may have been talking about Cook County as opposed to DuPage County. But the point is that's you know, seven times larger than the state of Wyoming or the state of Vermont. So anyhow, what the Electoral College does is it forces political candidates to campaign across most of America. If we did away with the Electoral College, then candidates could pick about 15 or 20 big cities and just campaign like crazy in them and ignore pretty much everything else. Because America's population has become so concentrated, rural areas would become irrelevant. The concerns of rural states and rural people would become irrelevant. And so, frankly, I think that the Electoral College is, while it's an artifact and an anachronism, I think it's a good one. And I'd like to keep the Electoral College. Back with more of your calls and my thoughts on the radical center right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And my brother Steve, who used to run political campaigns in Michigan, sent me a very thoughtful note over the weekend about what's going on in Michigan with Romney. I got to share that with you. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. And Peter Barnes writing about how to restore the middle class. I promise you I'm going to share with you some thoughts from my brother Steve, who used to run political campaigns in Michigan, about why Mitt Romney is failing in Michigan. And we'll get to that a little in a few minutes. But first, you know, our lines are filled up here. Let's pick up some phone calls. Dave in Kansas City, Kansas. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I just got a letter from our beloved Pat Roberts Saturday saying I joined 44 of my colleagues in co-sponsoring S-241. This legislation will give Congress the final authority to approve or deny construction of the Keystone Pipeline.
Right.
I thought we had this thing killed. Now he's going to try to override Obama.
Yeah. Yeah, of course they are. In fact, down in Texas, they've already used eminent domain to take like 65 different people's homes to build the pipeline. And finally, some woman stood up and said, no, you're not going to take my farm. And one of the Texas courts has put a hold on that eminent domain process. But this is going to be a tough one. Yeah, I mean, they're already well into building this pipeline, and President Obama has put a halt to it, and this is freaking out the oil industry, and the oil industry, of course, owns a lot of these politicians, like your senator. So we'll see where this goes. But thanks for the heads up on that, Dave. I appreciate the call. We'll see where it goes. Randy in Mock, Pennsylvania. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Good afternoon. I got a question. Why did the Vietnam protest draw so much protest and results? But the protest against our economic system seems to be futile. Explain this.
Well, it was because at the time of the Vietnam protests, our media was scattershot. At that time I was working in the Lansing radio market at WITL. And WVIC and WJIM and WFMK. I worked with several different radio stations there. And they were all, each one was independently owned and locally owned. and the television stations, the three TV stations that you could get in Lansing at that time, channels 6, 11, and I forget the other one, maybe 10. Those three channels, ABC, CBS, NBC, those companies were not part of giant transnational combines. We've, you know, when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in 82, what you saw was this explosion of smaller media companies aggregating into larger ones. So now it is not in the interest of these big companies to cover these kinds of economic protests. And the economic protests, media coverage is the oxygen on which protest movements thrive. Back during the Vietnam War days, the military-industrial complex, they were doing okay with the money that they were making on the war in Vietnam, but the war in Vietnam had not been privatized. There were millions to be made, but not billions to be made like there are now in these wars. And so the media was more fractured, it was more competitive, and there were requirements in place, the Fairness Doctrine specifically, that Reagan stopped enforcing in 87. There were requirements in place that you actually had to report what was going on. You actually had to report the news. That was a condition of having your radio TV stations have their licenses. And so that's why there's such a radical difference in coverage and impact of the people who were protesting the Vietnam War in the 60s and early 70s and the people who are now protesting the banksters. Randy, thanks for the call. I'm sorry I can't offer a more hopeful prospect other than that, you know, hopefully someday we're going to see the president say, okay, I'm going to roll back Reagan's policy and start enforcing the Sherman Act. Martha in Ithaca, New York, you wanted to disagree with me about the Electoral College.
Yeah, I love your program in general, but I was really shocked to hear you defend it. There are winners and losers no matter what the system is, but right now you defended the Electoral College saying that if we didn't have it, then politicians would ignore rural areas. Well, that's what they're doing to urban areas now. And people vote, not cows. When you think about the presidential campaigns are run in basically 18 states. I live in New York, right? What about the rest of us? We never see a presidential candidate.
Right.
And the problem is they could fix it if the electors were at least allocated proportionate to the votes cast. It would still be distorted because even the smallest state has two senators and the largest state has two senators. So that's the built-in bias for the rural states.
It is. It absolutely is. So how are you going to deal with, you know, if you go to direct election, how would you, you know, what would be the thing that would counterweight the fact that the presidential candidates could basically pick the top 15 or 20 cities? I've seen an analysis, and I it's been a year or two since I read it, so I'm sorry I don't remember the exact number, but I think it was either 18 or 22. The largest urban areas in the United States and only campaign there and ignore every other city in the United States, ignore all the rural areas, ignore everything else. If they could just win those, they would win the election.
What's the difference, Tom? They do that now by ignoring whole states.
Yeah, no,
because of the balance of the electors. And
right.
The problem is, I mean, if they're going to the cities, that's where the people are.
Yeah.
I mean, they should be elected by the majority of the people.
But New York State does have.
The other thing this would do, if we had proportional representation with the electors, then everybody would vote. There would be a reason. You could answer that woman's question by saying, yes, you should vote because your state's electors will be divvied up based on the total, you know, amount that your candidate got in that state. It's not a winner-take-all. Then that would affect all the down-ballot races as well. I think it would be a radical change in our...
It would require a constitutional amendment, though.
Fine. People are working on that.
And that's something that's not going to happen really fast. And so, you know, I see this as right for the moment as, you know, people who raise this, they raise it as an excuse not to vote. And, of course, that's exactly what the Republicans want. They want people not to vote.
Right.
And so I'm very, very wary of any of us buying into that. Now, there are things that can be done short of that. whether it's instant runoff voting like they do in San Francisco, or whether it's fusion voting like they do in New York State, where you can be on multiple parties' tickets at the same time. So John Kennedy, for example, ran on the Progressive Party as well as the Democratic Party
as long as all the electors are given to the one person, if they win by one vote, they get all the electors, then you have a system that is going to discourage people from voting. Because what difference does my one vote make? You know, so-and-so is going to win by a huge margin. That's why they're not advertising here. That's why they never come visit. Right. 38 states never, 36 states never get any election because any campaigning because they don't count.
I don't disagree that the system is broken. A national vote, in my opinion, as I said before, wouldn't be a bad thing. It would change the dynamic of our elections. But I think that the far more important issue is not, you know, how do we get Wyoming to have less influence and New York State to have more influence? Because they're not campaigning in New York, not because of the Electoral College. They're not campaigning in New York because they know that state has already flipped over the edge and it's going in a particular direction. It's by and large a Democratic state.
If a Republican candidate could get, say, a third of the electors, they might come here. And the Democrats might say that, well, I'm going to have to fight for every one of those votes.
Yeah.
I
understand. And if, in other words, if the electors were national rather than state by state.
Well,
so that you wouldn't, you couldn't,
according to the
right,
states.
Proportional to the states, so that you couldn't call an individual state. I agree with you.
And by leaving, and if you're worried about the rural areas, as long as you've left the Senate with two votes for even the smallest state, the same number as the largest state, then you've got a counterbalance there.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. The question is, how are you going to do it? And I believe that any of these changes that you and I are discussing right now are going to require a constitutional amendment. So which isn't going to happen right now. So Martha, we need to be focusing our efforts on how to get, you know, how to get more precinct committee people within the Democratic Party, how to get more progressives within the Democratic Party, how to flip that party in a more progressive direction, frankly, in my opinion. Martha, thank you for the call. Carl in Halleck, Minnesota. We got a minute to the break. Carl, what's up?
Yeah, you were explaining in terms of the Vietnam War why the protests were so much more successful back then than they are now. I think one of the big factors is there was a draft back then.
You're right.
And everybody had a personal stake in it.
You're right. And this is, you know, I've had Charlie Rangel on this show for a number of times because he's the one guy in Congress who's out there saying we need a draft. He's a decorated World War II veteran. And, you know, we need a draft, we need a draft, we need a draft. And I agree with him. I think that there should be at least a year of national service after people graduate from high school. And in exchange for that, they get a GI Bill. They get and they don't have to go into the military. They could work in hospitals. They could work in group homes. They could work in our national forests, whatever. But they have to do a year of national service, and then after that, they get free college. And you're right. If we had a draft, and if members of Congress and lobbyists, if their kids were going to be drafted and sent off to war, we wouldn't have had the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. Thank you, Carl, for pointing that out. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Why is Mitt Romney sinking in his home state, my home state of Michigan? Some insights, my brother.
Oh, come Monday, it'll be all right. Come Monday.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Bill in Prescott, Arizona. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Howdy, Tom. Trust your health is doing well for you now.
I am getting better, yes. Thank you.
Great. Glad to hear it. Just a sideline, back in 1792 today, Postal Service Act was signed by President George Washington.
Wow.
So I hope this decade isn't the one that they get rid of it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they're certainly taking a meat axe to it.
But that's not really why I'm calling. I live in Prescott, Arizona, a little more progressive because we have three colleges here, but not much. And I really respect what you're saying is getting involved in local politics. You just got back from Chicago. I grew up in Chicago, and it was fun to be involved.
Yeah.
But in a state like Arizona, the Democratic Party, and it's not to their fault, but it's really lame. There's not much to do. So I'm asking, is there anything else that you can think of that a person can do other than just go down and try to get involved at the local level or something?
Well, I was talking to one of the, in fact, I talked about this in my keynote day before yesterday and in Illinois, in DuPage County, about how they had, back 6-8 years ago, that county was one of the most Republican counties in the United States, very, very Republican, very reliably Republican. And some progressive activists got together, and they started this project, Turn DuPage Blue. And the first step was to get, and it turned into a movement. It was to get people to come to the Democratic Party meetings, to have people volunteer for precinct committeeman positions, or committee person would be the politically correct way to call it, but the law actually refers to them as committee men in Illinois anyway. And they took over the party, and now, you know, the Democrats are pretty much running or have a very, very loud voice in DuPage County, and there's a number of congressional districts in that very large, large county that are probably going to flip Democratic. And Tammy Duckworth was there. I met with her, spent some time talking with her, you know, Governor Quinn and others. And the thing that people don't get is that there is this one job. People say, well, how, you know, I don't feel like my member of Congress is listening to me, or I don't like the, you know, the party platform, right? There's one job that allows you to write the party platform, to pick who are going to be the primary nominees, and makes you the first person that when members of Congress and the two senators come back to town, you're the one that they look up and talk to, and that's becoming a precinct committee person. And because the precinct committee people literally are the ones who make those choices. And in 2008, when Obama was elected, one of the major efforts of the Koch brothers and Dick Armey and Freedom Works and the whole Tea Party thing, one of their major efforts, and the websites are still up, you can find them, they've got YouTubes describing exactly how to do it, was to get Tea Partiers to become committee precinct people in the Republican Party. Because if they could, and one of them says right in the video, and we'll have to dig out the clips one of these days, because, you know, I've actually played these on the air. These are clips coming from the Republicans, or from the Tea Partiers, from the billionaires running the Tea Party, who wanted to take over the Republican Party, saying, if you can get, you know, say there's going to be a primary and there's going to be three candidates in the Republican Party, if all three of them are Tea Partiers, then it doesn't matter which one wins, because we've won. And that's what they did, and that's why you've got about 100 new Tea Partiers and 250 of them at the state level across the nation, and almost 100 of them at the federal level all across the country. And because the Tea Party tried this strategy, and it worked. And that's what progressives need to do with the Democratic Party. So I would say, in fact, here, I got a couple of clips from the Republicans about this. Jacob, fire one of them off.
What's the most powerful political office in the world? It is not the President of the United States. It's precinct committeemen. Why? There's three main reasons. First, because precinct committeemen and only precinct committeemen get to elect the leaders of the political parties. If you want to elect the leadership of one of the two major political parties in this country, then you have to become a precinct committeeman.
And here's the second one.
Second, precinct committeemen and only precinct committeemen can vote in internal party elections to endorse candidates in the all-important, traditionally very low turnout primary elections.
See, this,
if a candidate wins the general election, he first has to get onto the general election ballot. To get on the general election ballot, he has to win the primary election. And the best way to win the primary election is to get the endorsement of as many party committees as possible. Precinct committeemen are organized into committees. For example, every county has a party committee. Every state legislative district has a committee. Legislative districts elect the people's representatives to the state legislature.
And then here's the last one.
Now, the third reason you want to become a precinct committeeman is because in some states, when a vacancy occurs in a state legislator office, precinct committeemen and only precinct committeemen, not registered voters, get to nominate three nominees to fill the vacancy. The County Board of Supervisors then select the replacement. If, under a system like this, a majority of the precinct committeemen are conservatives, then all three nominees will be conservatives, and the eventually selected replacement will be a conservative. That's real political power.
So, Bill, that's from a website called Concord Project. I believe it's .org, and it is the Concord Project. And it was a Tea Party project to take over the Republican Party, and that was one of their videos. And they played these in house parties all across the United States and got people to show up at the Republican Party and say, I want to be a committee precinct person. And they reinvigorated the party to the right. And this is what, you know, the Dems are doing in DuPage County and around the country. And it's what you could be doing there in Prescott. Make sense?
Throw this out to you, Tom.
Sure.
I mean, I'm in the progressive wilderness out here. I mean, I have a lot of, I live in a retirement community. I have a lot of neighbors that were in the Tea Party or at least promoted it. And a lot of them have turned around because they don't like where the country's going.
Right. Well, get.
And they're even saying that it's so entrenched in this state. That's not going to work. If you have any other suggestions what to do, I would definitely push it.
Okay, well, that's my number one, Bill, is get inside the party and take it over. And I you know, and the other is movement politics. Join all the movements you can. PDAmerica.org, for example. Check it out.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Ronald Bailey is the science correspondent for Reason Magazine. Reason.com is the website. He's the author of Liberation Biology, the Moral and Scientific Case for the Biotech Revolution. In other words, GMOs are good for you. Ron, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
We're not going to be debating GMOs right now. I just, you know, that's your most recent book and put it out. And did I characterize it right, by the way?
Well, I'm also in favor of using stem cells, for example, to treat people's diseases and those kinds of things.
Sure, yeah. But with regard to GMOs, yes. Okay. Right now, this whole oil price thing is being used. I mean, it's like at the top of Drudge. Every time the price of oil goes up, the Drudge Report goes, oh, look at this. The price of oil has just gone up. And yet when you look at the stats, and to Tom Clauso, who's probably the best guy in this, he's the chief oil analyst for the Oil Price Information Service, he says demand for gasoline right now is at the lowest it has been since April of 1997, at which time, you know, the price of gasoline was, I believe, under $2. And in addition to that, the number one manufactured export of the United States right now, keep in mind, 15 years ago, we imported gasoline. Gasoline has now become our number one export. So our domestic demand is very low, and we're exporting massive amounts of gasoline, and yet the price is going up. Why?
Well, of course, the oil market is a global market, and demand across the globe has been going up as the economy has improved since the 2008 recession started. So there's demand from China and India are growing as well, and so you see the demand for oil growing up. But, of course, the other thing that's going on right now is the geopolitical risk problem with Iran threatening to close the Straits of Hormuz because of the new sanctions that we in the European Union are trying to impose on them.
Yeah, I get all that. But, number one, we now know in retrospect that the 2008 gas spike was largely engineered by three Wall Street banks. That they were hedging, that they were buying massive amounts of long positions on oil, and they drove up the price of oil, and then they bailed out very quickly, and the price of oil crashed. And similarly, again, going back to the Petroleum Information Service, they say right now we're seeing $11 billion worth of speculative money coming into gasoline futures every week. He said each of the last 3 weeks we've seen a record net long position being taken, even beating the numbers in 2008. And these are the kind of things that drive up the price of gasoline. And these purchases are not being made by oil companies, retail oil companies, who will sell the gasoline. They're being made by bankers who are hoping to profit on the speculation. So, it's fairly obvious the speculation is playing a big piece in the price of gasoline. It's going up faster than the price of oil has.
Well, speculation is merely just the futures price. It is not anything.
No, this is different. If you're talking the futures price, you're talking, you know, theoretically, you should be. We should. I mean, before 1999. The way that the oil futures were had to be sold, bought or sold, is that you, if you were a counterparty to a purchase or a sale, you had to be willing to actually take delivery of that gasoline. And you'll recall Goldman Sachs in 1999 went into, or in, no, in, yeah, in 99 or 2001, one of the year or the other, went to the SEC and said, we would like an exemption so that we can trade oil commodities, oil futures. And even though we're forbidden from doing so because we're not actually a consumer of oil, we would like to be able to do that because we're going to create a commodities index. And they were granted that exemption, and they came up with the Goldman Sachs Commodities Index. And rather than being the small player that the SEC envisioned at the time, Goldman Sachs became a major player. And now all the banks are in this. They've all been granted one at a time over the last, you know, actually over the first 3 years after that 99 decision, were all granted exemptions. And so now you see these banksters in there playing in the oil market, and they have no intention. They're not manufacturing oil. They're not producing it or gasoline, and they're not buying it. They're not consuming it. This is wrong. This is creating wild dislocations. When they did it with food prices back in 2008, you had literally thousands of people around the world starved to death. You had riots in a half a dozen states. You had people, you know, governments being destabilized simply because these guys had gotten this exemption from the SEC and they could trade commodities in unregulated, invisible markets, and they could trade commodities that they had no intention of taking possession of. It's
wrong.
Well,
markets aren't invisible in the first place because you could go out and buy one of these if you wanted to as your own contract. The other thing is that, let's face it.
It is invisible if you don't have to do it on a listed exchange.
One moment. As the last time we had this run-up in prices, back in 2008, you'll recall it went up to $142 a barrel. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission looked into the claims of speculation, and I quote, preliminary analysis to date does not support the proposition that speculative activity has systematically driven prices, changes in the oil prices.
I absolutely disagree, and your quote is taken out of context. They also pointed out that speculation did play a role in the price of oil.
No, basically what you'll recall
is that it wasn't the major driver.
We had an Arab Spring situation brewing, and essentially we had the Libyan oil prices going down. I mean, we had a huge...
Right, it wasn't the major driver, but it was the banks jumping on the back of that.
It was the
banks jumping on the back of that saying, oh boy, look at this, we can drive this, and then you get this thing. I mean,
what happened to the oil price in 2008 after it peaked in July of 19 at $142 a barrel?
When the banks started getting out of the business, when the banks started walking away, the price collapsed.
And so, who made money then?
The banks did. They took their profits and ran.
How did they make money on lower prices?
I beg your pardon?
How did they make money on the lower prices?
You make money by bailing out of the position before the price drops.
There has to be or in many on both of, in, sides of a trade. To
okay,
take a
in many of these cases, this was not proprietary trading. This was banks doing the trades on behalf of institutional investors, on behalf of pension funds, things like that.
Your 401k is invested, right?
And exactly, and those are the people who got screwed, not the banks. The banks make money on the way up. The banks make money on the way down because they're making their money on commissions on the trading.
I thought you said they were trading. Now they're just making commissions.
Well, they're doing
the
both. They were doing proprietary trading, and you know that. And they were also doing trading on behalf of their partners. And my point is that we should go back to 1999 and pre-1999 when you didn't see these wild price swings in commodity prices and say, if you're going to trade a commodity, you have to be willing to either supply it or take delivery of it.
Actually, if you go back over the history, there's a wonderful study done by an economist at the University of California, San Diego, named James Hamilton, where he's looked at the oil price swings from World War II to the present. They're all the result of, if you will, supply bottlenecks that occurred for various reasons, usually geopolitical reasons. And in every case, that's what happened. It wasn't speculation that caused the price to run up. It was the fact that supply ran short very quickly in a very short period of time.
But supply is, right now there is a world surplus of oil. The world is awash in oil.
No, actually, what happens is, and this is, you can almost guarantee it, every time the global spare capacity gets below 3 million barrels, the price starts shooting up. And we're at that point now.
Then the oil companies are withholding oil.
No!
You think OPEC doesn't play a role in defining their own production to maintain the price of oil?
90 please understand this. 89% of the world's oil is owned by governments.
And some of that is OPEC. And I realize OPEC only controls, what is it, 38% of the world's oil?
But Nigeria, Angola, Venezuela, Mexico, Brazil, these are all government oil companies.
Sure. And when OPEC keeps the price high, everybody wins. Everybody who's producing oil.
Again, but that's not speculation. That is the fact that somebody is constricting supply. Whether it's geopolitically done because of the fears that you have that Iran might do something silly. Or if
so bottom line is you're unwilling to say that if commodities are traded, they have to be traded in an open market, and the people who are the counterparties to those trades have to be willing to buy or sell that commodity.
Well, I'll go with the open market. I don't think that you need to require that you accept the commodity.
So speculation's fine with you?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's the nub of the issue, and that's where we separate company. Ron Bailey, Reason.com. You can read all about the science correspondent for Reason Magazine. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 15 minutes past the hour. Do you think that the banks should be major participants in the oil markets? I don't.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And why is Mitt Romney failing in Michigan? Some interesting thoughts from a former Michigan Republican political consultant. Happy President's Day. We're cycling through pictures of presidents here on our video stream. Neil in Riverside, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Neil, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I have an idea that I stole from J.L. Biafra. That is, we should make none of the above an option on all local and national elections. And how it works, it has worked in places like Europe. If none of the above wins a majority, they have to rerun the election with all new candidates.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot run again. And
reboot the election.
Absolutely. We wouldn't have to pick from the lesser of two evils, at least less so, because they would be forced to actually adhere to the will of the people much more than they are now.
That's a very interesting proposal. I don't know if it would require any kind of legislation or constitutional amendment. I'm not sure how that would be put into law. Or put into place, but it sounds like a great idea. But the other thing is if you want to avoid picking between the lesser of two evils, then on your side, whichever that may be, do what those guys who run the Tea Party were teaching Tea Party activists to do when they took over the Republican Party in 2009 and 2010, is get inside the Democratic Party and take it over with progressives and run that party. Thank you, Neil, for the call. Jacob, you've got a couple more clips from the Concord Coalition. This is one of the Tea Party groups that was teaching people how to take over the Republican Party, and you can see these on their website. This is from one of their YouTubes.
How does one become a precinct committeeman? Bottom line, every state has different rules and procedures for becoming a precinct committeeman with full voting rights within the parties. And each party within each state may have different rules. In Arizona, for example, you must be elected to the office of precinct committeeman. But you don't have to get more than 10 signatures of registered voters from your party or from independents to get your name on the primary ballot. Precinct committeemen in Arizona are not required to pay dues. Ohio's system is similar to Arizona's. Other states require dues and require precinct committeemen attend meetings and sign pledges to support the party's candidates. Arizona's system does not require meeting attendance.
And in fact, one of the earlier callers that we had, the caller that we had that provoked this whole conversation, as I recall, was from Flagstaff or Prescott, Arizona. And so there you go. For you. I'm sorry I don't remember your name, but it's there you go. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to change the conversation a little bit. A few weeks ago, you talked to a Dr. Alex McFarland, and this is in relation to the state of Arizona putting in regulations that were absolutely ridiculous about how teachers can speak in the classroom and using the FCC standards. And what I wanted to say was that I just hate the hypocrisy of the religious right when they talk about outward actions of people, but yet they never want to talk about substantive economic issues that would cause people to perhaps be angry and crass and act out and these kinds of things. And, you know, I just wanted to know what you thought about that. You had brought up in recent programs about different Catholic popes coming up with encyclicals about the rights of workers. And I looked that up, and actually since Pope Leo, which was in 1890, there have been, I think, three or four that directly talked about rights of workers. And yet I never see any Catholic bishops out there, you know, with the 99%, you know, just trying to bring attention to these issues. They're so focused on abortion, and gay rights, and it's just so hypocritical. I think that even from a, you know, a religious point of view, that they're just turning people off to their religion.
I'm not a Catholic, so I can't judge or even say, you know, what it must be like for Catholics. But the fact of the matter is, you're right. The Catholic Church has been for over a century on record as being on the side of organized labor. They've also been for over a century on record as being on the side of having national health care policies, that health care should be a right and not a privilege. And that's a great one. I'd ask my brother, Steve, who used to back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, he used to run political campaigns in Michigan very often for Republican candidates, although I know that Steve would not describe himself as a Republican anymore. But Steve, I called him over the weekend and I said, you know, what's going on in Michigan? Why is Mitt Romney not getting any traction? Because when Steve and I were little kids, George Romney was governor of Michigan, and everybody thought fairly well of him. And Steve sent me a long note on after our conversation, kind of summarizing his thoughts. He said, well, one more factor that has a major effect on people's perception of Romney is our current governor, Rick Schneider. He says, Schneider ran as a business nerd, proclaiming that business success automatically meant success as a governor. He's a multimillionaire or more like Romney. And he's been governing, in many people's estimation, in a similar way to Romney in Massachusetts. And then Steve goes on to say the radical right-wingers here are upset with him because Snyder's not picking up their pet issues, God's gays and guns. And he said he thinks Snyder's doing this because he wants to get reelected. He wants to keep the moderate middle. He says the average Republican, that's the moderate middle in the Republican Party, isn't happy with him, Steve says, because he hasn't addressed their needs. Most of these people are middle class. Many are state employees, and all of them are being hit hard by Snyder's policies. And then Steve goes on to say most of the things that have moved us forward have been from the federal level with the bailout of the auto industry and the highway repair initiatives, et cetera, here in the state of Michigan. And Snyder and Romney has opposed those things. And then he says the conservative Democrats, the Blue Dogs, et cetera, who crossed over and voted for Schneider aren't happy with him for the same reason as the independents. He said, I think some of them actually thought he'd be a Ross Perot type and support changes to trade policies. And Steve adds, sometimes I think Schneider tailored his policy to be seen as a Romney Republican because of Romney's popularity at that time. And it's backfiring on Romney because Romney is viewed in Michigan as Rick Snyder. He says, right now, Michigan is not a good place to be a rich, snobbish politician, and Romney really doesn't seem to know how to be anything else. And he said, there's a new rule, for example, that was put into place that allows the parties to use their voting records from the primaries to acquire information about the voters, but now they're selling this, and so a lot of people don't even want to vote in the primaries because they're worried about telemarketers and stalkers.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So a very, very interesting perspective there on, you know, it's Rick Schneider who's tearing down Mitt Romney. Oh, very interesting. Very interesting. In Michigan.
It's about time we win. It's about time we win.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, it's our cheesy news alert. This courtesy of Andy Borowitz, theborowitzreport.com. As North Korea ramped up its threats to attack South Korea, CNN reassured its viewers that a nuclear war in the Korean Peninsula would have, quote, no effect whatsoever, end quote, on its Whitney Houston coverage. As viewers, Wolf Blitzer, host of the network Situation Room, said, as viewers, you have come to trust us to deliver the news whenever it happens, wherever it happens, as long as that news is about Whitney Houston. We will never do anything to break that trust. As Mr. Blitzer spoke, 23 of the Situation Room's 24 video monitors featured images of Ms. Houston, with the 24th featuring an image of her ex, Bobby Brown. The news from CNN sent a chill through the senior leadership of North Korea, who announced later today that it might postpone a nuclear war until later in the week when the Whitney Houston coverage calms down. Good luck with that, Mr. Blitzer said. The Oscars are this Sunday. Meanwhile, in what some political insiders are calling a sign of desperation, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney today had his first name legally changed to Not. And a new study showed that the election of former Senator Rick Santorum would solve the U.S.'s immigration problems but create enormous ones for Canada. Thank you, Andy Borowitz. Yes, of course, it's all tongue-in-cheek news. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Scott in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I mentioned this a couple weeks ago when you were sick to Carl Frisch.
Mm-hmm.
In response to a statement that Rick Santorum had made in Colorado about at an energy summit where he said, talking about the EPA and climate change, he said, we're put here on this earth as creatures of God to have dominion over the earth, to use it wisely and steward it wisely, but for our benefit, not for the earth's benefit.
Right.
And I mentioned on my Facebook page that, you know, I was a monk for 25 years, and I said, sorry, Rick, but dominion over the earth doesn't mean that we own it. We can use it and rape it for our sense gratification. It means that the earth is God's property.
Right.
We're charged with protecting it.
Yeah, he is mischaracterizing Genesis, first of all, and the teachings of every other great religion in the world. And
exactly.
And secondly, the logical endpoint of that is death and destruction for our species, which is insane. But, you know, nobody ever accused Rick Santorum of being, you know, the brightest bulb on the tree. So anyhow, thanks a lot for the call,
I
Scott.
I think the idea of proprietorship, though, is ever since Bush had the ownership generation, right?
Yeah. The ownership society. Yeah.
The ownership society. And this is a really important concept, and it has to do with environmentalism, and it also has to do with, you know, the fact that we don't own really anything.
Yeah, no.
Arguably,
You know, another way to say it is that as a society, as a culture, we own everything in as much as we have the ability to manipulate it, use it, and possess it. But, you know, ownership forever is not a concept that's possible for humans. We don't live forever. And that, you know, we have an obligation to future generations. The Iroquois Confederacy required all decisions to be made in the context of their impact on the seventh generation. And we need to have that kind of thinking. Scott, thank you for the call. Well said. From Scott to Scott. Scott in Skowhegan, Maine?
Yep, that's right. You got it right, Tom.
So what's up, Scott?
Hey, man, I watch you on RT. That's a good station, too.
Thank you. So what's up?
Hey, listen, I needed to know with the oil stuff. What would happen if we federalized the oil companies?
Well, that's
you know what I mean. Nationalize them to get rid of all them radical swings that goes up and down.
Right. That's what Norway did. That's what Venezuela did. It's what Iraq did and Iran did back in the 50s, and we overthrew their governments democratically elected governments as a result of it. It's what Saudi Arabia tried to do, and we cut a deal with them, and that was the beginning of Aramco, and said, no, don't, you know, 50-50, let's do a 50-50. And it's what Alaska does. Alaskans have the Permanent Trust Fund and the Alaska Permanent Fund, and every year, if you live in Alaska, you get a check of typically between $1,000 and $2,000 a year. Sarah Palin passed out checks to everybody in the state. In fact, I think one year she got it above $2,000. It was when she was running for something, for midterms or whatever, as governor. And she got, you know, and this is money that comes from the oil revenues. Now, the state is asserting ownership over the oil in the ground and saying, we will license that oil to you and you will pay us a licensing fee. And that fee then goes
basically
into
our oil.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that we should do it nationwide. I'm totally with you, Scott. I think it's an excellent suggestion. Renee in Judah, Wisconsin. Hey, Renee, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to alert some of your viewers, and if they can at all be part of Occupy the PGA from the 23rd to the 27th in Benton Harbor. They've already sold part of their park.
Right.
To some development, from what I understand, and they're trying to get ready to close the high school down. I mean, they're just in
Benton Harbor. Benton Harbor being the relatively poor African-American community on the other side of the river from the affluent white community, St. Joe, in on the western coast of Michigan, on Lake Michigan, that has been taken over. Their elected representatives have been thrown out. We've had one of their city councilmen on this program a number of times, and replaced by one of Rick Snyder's crony dictator buddies, who is, as you correctly point out, selling off the city. So Occupy the PGA. What are the dates again?
From the May 23rd to the 27th, and they do have a Facebook page. It's www.occupythepga.
Right, okay, occupythepga.
So if whatever we can do, please, because, I mean, it's this. If this starts what's happening from taking our national parks and doing the same thing.
Yeah, no, it's an incredible and insane process that and thank you for the call, that these Republicans are following. You've got Rick Santorum out there. He was in Idaho saying, oh, look at all this federal land. Why don't we just privatize it? Why don't we sell it off to people, to rich people? Well, that private land has produced $1 billion in revenue for the federal government. That private land is our national parks. That's our heritage. That's what we own in common. It's part of our commons. Randy in Sioux City, Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You piqued my interest on these gas prices and the fluctuation. No, I don't think banks should be involved in trading, speculative trading on commodities that they're not involved with. My point is, and this is in reference to the gas prices crashing in 11/19, right after President Obama was elected, 08. And prior to that, in 2003, like in November of 2003, we were maintaining $1.30 a gallon, $1.31. After the Bush energy policy, it went to $1.70, and then it escalated with a peak in 2005 of July of 2005 of approximately $3. Now, what I'm wondering is, do you associate not the elevation in price, but this big trough that we found when in 11/2008 to speculation by the banks, or is there some other factor in there that caused that? It just stands out.
I genuinely don't know about what was going on back in 2008, although I believe it's Matt Taibbi has written some really good pieces for the Rolling Stone about this issue and the manipulation of gas prices, and Greg Palast has done some very, very good investigative research on this. I do know that last month, when President Obama was confronted with the Keystone XL pipeline, and he postponed it, he put it off, and he said, no, not for now, that the head of the American Petroleum Institute came out and said that he was going to extract a heavy political price from Obama. And now we're seeing gasoline. And then last week you had people from the American Petroleum Institute or other organizations associated with them suggesting that the price of gasoline could hit $4 or $5 a barrel before election time. And I'm of the opinion that they're doing that to try to harm Obama politically. But I
agree.
I can't demonstrate that. And the banksters then climb on the back of that and make a zillion bucks. I mean, as I said, they make money when the market goes up. They make money when the market goes down. It doesn't matter. Randy, thank you for the call. David in Rockford, Illinois. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Great. Well, I'll get better.
I hope you're doing a lot better with that cough of yours.
I am. It's pretty much gone.
Yeah. No, actually, I called in last week Wednesday. I'm Dave from Occupy Rockford.
Okay, great.
Yeah, no, I wanted to just give a quick update on what we had done this given weekend. We had our second teach-in on the Citizens United, and getting money out of politics, all that stuff. And it turned out to be a pretty good time. We had about 8 new faces, which is not much, but for our second one, I guess that's to be expected. You know, you got to start small and work your way up, I guess.
Yep.
Yeah, and I also wanted to, let you know that, there's still, for those here in the, at least in my area, the Rockford area, we still got about 60 or so empty precinct committeeman seats that are still empty. So we need some volunteers willing to step up and fill them up for me.
So if you're a progressive in Rockford, Illinois, and you want to be the person that the member of Congress comes back and talks to, you want to be the person who picks who's going to be the primary candidate, you want to be the person who writes the party platform, there's 60 of them in Rockford openings?
Well, actually, when I called you back in November, we had 71 total empty precinct seats.
Amazing.
That still remains. But I've got about 7 or 8 people from the Occupy movement.
That's great. Fill it as full as you can. David, we're out of time, but fill it as full as you can. That's great. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So the new mantra is occupy the committee precinct person's seats and thus occupy the Democratic Party.
Everyone addicted to the same nicotine. Everyone addicted to the same gasoline. Everyone addicted to a technicolor screen. Everybody trying to get their hands on the same green. From the banks of the river to the banks of the greedy.
Welcome back. Here we go. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, Dana Perino this morning on GOP TV, also known as Fox So-Called News, talking about how, she actually doesn't say that Obama blamed Bush for high gas prices, because as I said, he didn't. But there were some people who were. Here we go.
And all of a sudden, the media is talking about the laws of supply and demand and putting things in context. When President Bush was president, they talked about oil speculators, that they were the problem, and who's friends with big oil?
Were.
President Bush. And so they would put it right. All together like that. And if you look at the New York Times on Saturday or Sunday this weekend, the headline on the front page was gas prices gives GOP something to attack. I mean, that's the way they look at it. It wasn't Obama's gas prices problem. It was right. The GOP is now going to attack him, this good man who's done nothing wrong.
Nothing wrong. Other than slow down the permitting process on offshore drilling, decline the XL pipeline, which could actually bring 700,000 barrels of oil per day into the country, dropping.
We don't need that for our electric cars.
Amazing. He slowed down the permitting process when the BP oil spill was going on, and then he sped it back up again afterwards. And it's just incredible. It's just incredible. The propaganda. Bobby in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Bobby, what's on your mind?
Hi, well, my question is, I don't know if you've heard that the state legislature here in Arizona, which I consider one of the most regressive states in the nation, they are considering reducing the minimum wage by state mandate, I guess, for two groups, and that would be people who are under 20 and work part-time, and those who receive tips. Two groups who probably could use all the money, you know, because many of them are in school.
Right.
Or it might be me, who knows. But I just wondered, do you think this might be the beginning of what they did, the attack on labor unions, that the Republican-dominated legislatures, I'm sorry, I can't talk morning, that maybe it's something that's going to spread?
Well, of course it is. There are many states where that's already the case. And what you're seeing is in other states where, you know, you have to pay waiters and waitresses at least minimum wage plus tips. And in some states that minimum wage is fairly high, like it is in Oregon. But it works just fine, thank you very much. And when they raised the minimum wage, they actually saw the economy go up and they saw the state revenues go up. But the bottom line is that what you have is a Republican Party and a conservative base run mostly by and for billionaires that has sucked in a bunch of sad suckers, frankly. People who watch Fox News, who watch these multimillionaire commentators on Fox News, and every single one of them is, and who watch these people promoting the interests of the millionaires and billionaires in this country, the oil industry in this country, and the banking industry in this country, and think, oh yeah, that's the American way. And at the same time, demoting the interests of working people in this country, because that's contrary to the interests of the billionaires and the multimillionaires. And this is the war on working people. Bobby, thank you for the call, and thanks for pointing it out. Gordon in O'Brien, Oregon. Hey, Gordon, what's up? Thanks for listening to KPOJ.
Hey, Tom, it's good to talk to you. What I wanted to talk about is the number of representatives in the House of Representatives.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't set to 435 until 1911.
Right.
By an act of Congress. And I thought you could review some of the history of that. For instance, in 1789, there were 65 representatives.
Yeah.
1865, 191. And it increased to 437 when they added Hawaii and Alaska. So there.
It added to 435, actually, I think, at that time.
Well, went up to 437 because they added Alaska and Hawaii temporarily.
I see. And then it went back down to
435 in 1963. But the point is now there's 700,000 representative or people for each representative. and the founding fathers argued over like 35,000 or 25,000.
Yeah.
I think what they ought to do is increase the number of representatives in the House to 10,001 for about 35,000 for each. And that way you'd solve the Electoral College thing. You'd have to have 5,051 to get elected.
Oh, interesting. And you're right. That would diminish the impact of the Electoral College. And
it would increase democracy, too.
Yeah, you're right.
A state like Oregon, we now have 5 representatives. We'd have 100.
Right.
We'd have 2 in Josephine County, where I am.
Right. You'd have much
like
more
California,
much more local say.
Yeah, and in California, you'd have 1,000 representatives.
Yeah.
You just have to build a bigger room, but they have electronic voting anyway.
Right. Yeah.
You could have more.
Fascinating idea. Thank you for sharing that, Gordon. I like it. It would require an active.
There's no reason it can't be done. I've just Googled the number of House of Representatives, and it changed an amazing number of times.
Well, it has. One of the problems with 10,000 of them is that you'd have to rebuild the Capitol building because you couldn't fit that many people in there. But India has the largest Democratic parliament in the world. And I don't recall the number, but I think it's on the order of 700-800. It's fairly large. But 10,000 would be a stretch. During the Greek democracy, it was 6,000. You had 6,001 people for a quorum in Athens. So, you know, there's precedent for it. Gordon, thank you for the call. It's an interesting idea. Joseph in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Joseph, what's up?
Well, I just want to make a comment that I think that's a good idea because the oil belongs to everybody because the land. And the same line in Orlando, Florida, you have people that bottle water and then they sell it and we don't get anything for that. And also in the summer comes, you know, they put you on restriction because you can't use the water.
Right.
And at the same time, they make millions probably selling our water without paying nothing, contributing nothing to the state.
Right. We need to start
the same thing and the same line that should do that with the minerals.
I agree. Peter Barnes wrote a brilliant piece that was published over in Common Dreams on February 17th, last Friday. It was called How to Restore the Middle Class, Let Everyone Earn Dividends from Our Common Wealth, the Commons. And basically what he says is, you know, let's do this on the model of the Alaska Permanent Fund and let's commodify the commons in as much as they're being used. So, for example, when companies pump pollution into the air, we should charge them for that. And then we should share that money with all the people who share the air, who share ownership of the air. And similarly, the water, if somebody, you know, if a company wants to take some of the water and bottle it and sell it, we should be making a piece of that. And for that matter, he points out that companies, when they go public, their stock value goes up. Why? Because of regulation, which we provide at no cost to them. They should pay us for it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Carolyn Isaacs is the director of the American Friends Services Committee's Arizona Program. She is the author of a new report on the state of things with regard to the private prison industry. In fact, I have it in my hand here. Private Prisons, the Public's Problem, a Quality Assessment of Arizona's Private Prisons. This was just published this month, February 2012. AFSC, the website. And Carolyn, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. We've had several debates over the years and even recently about whether prisons should be privatized. I've always held the position that prisons are part of our police commons, as it were, and therefore there's no business for private corporations operating purely for profit to be in that business. You've really dug into this deeply. What are the consequences of privatization? The advocates of it say, you know, private corporations can do things more efficiently and more cheaply, and therefore the state's going to get a better deal. How does it work out in reality?
Well, I would challenge them to prove it because we actually endeavored to do the first comprehensive review of those claims specifically on the private prisons located here in Arizona. And we learned several things. One is that the cost savings simply have not materialized. So if that was the main basis for doing this, saying that the private industry can do things more cheaply than the government, there's no evidence to support
that. Well, they can do them more cheaply, but they take that extra money and they pay their CEOs multi-million dollar salaries and they pay their stockholders dividends. CCA, the last quarter of last year, their dividend was over 8%. So that's skimming a whole chunk of money off the top.
They're certainly making money, but yeah, they are undoubtedly not saving money in the state of Arizona.
They're not saving money for the state.
Arizona Department of Corrections has studied the cost comparison model for 6 years here and found that we're actually overpaying for those facilities.
Interesting. And one of the thoughts that occurred to me is if I was running a private prison industry, and I know CCA, for example, has gone out to 48 states last week and sent out a memo saying we're interested in buying your existing prisons. If you buy a facility, it's like buying a bridge or a road or anything else, you buy it and just milk all the profit you can out of it for, say, a decade or two decades and then abandon it and never do any maintenance, you could make substantial profit off that, whereas if the state owns it every year, they would maintain it and keep building it up. Is there any evidence that private prison companies that have taken over state-owned prisons have done that sort of thing?
Well, this is fascinating, actually, because I view this as a true desperation move on the part of CCA. Arizona attempted to privatize existing state complexes a few years back, and they couldn't get any takers, right? Because generally, private prisons want to take the prisoners that are the cheapest to house. They want the low level. They don't want that burden.
They want the Bernie Madoffs, not the killers.
Right. So that CCA would send a memo like that says to me that they are sweating right now because state prison populations are dropping, states are closing prisons, they're enacting sentencing reforms to send fewer people to prison, crime is down, and that hurts CCA's bottom line. So what are they going to do? Well, they're going to go where the prisoners already are,
right,
and now they're going to make this offer to buy existing prison.
Right, and they're going to lobby, although they don't do it directly, but they do it indirectly by supporting candidates who are of the same mind, basically lobbying for stronger prison sentences for a whole wide variety of crimes, keep Nixon's drug law intact, you know, drug war, keep that going, and all those kinds of things.
Okay.
So Arizona is apparently wasting money on privatization of prisons. Is there an issue of security? The reason why we have prisons is to keep people who are dangerous out of our general population, to protect ourselves from the predators among us. That's one of the reasons why we have prisons. And another is to rehabilitate people so that they can successfully reintegrate into society. Do these private prisons have any kind of an advantage over state-owned prisons with regard to either of those two issues, with regard to security or regard to recidivism? Because one of the arguments that I've heard is that they have lower recidivism rates than state prisons. Is that just because they're cherry-picking their customers?
Recidivism. No. We have asked all three of the private prison corporations that were pursuing new contracts in Arizona about their recidivism rates, and we were told they do not measure recidivism flat out. They don't even bother. So there's no evidence to support that. In terms of the safety issues, we actually found very, very spotty safety records where we could get them, right? Because the first problem that we have here is that private prisons are private corporations. They don't have to tell us about their safety records, their recidivism, or anything else. They're not required to disclose this to the public the way that a state prison is.
But can't a state make that part of their contract?
If they choose to.
But then you're
at the mercy of whoever's, you know, in your state procurement office. The people,
right,
the state of Arizona, has no oversight in terms of the law,
right,
over these facilities. And then you have, in Arizona, six private prisons, all operated by Corrections Corporation of America, that don't contract with the state. They just set up shop here, and they import prisoners from California or Hawaii or the federal government, ICE detainees. And we have virtually no oversight over those prisons whatsoever.
Whoa. And do those prisons, what's so great about Arizona? Is it that it's a warm place and so it's less expensive?
We got
to
wide
eat,
open spaces, and we have very permissive laws,
and we have
a legislature that's going to look the other way.
Amazing. Amazing. But back to the question of security, do people escape from private prisons at a higher rate? Is there also the issue of, you know, prisoner, you know, they're not reporting on recidivism, but there have to be some indices that you can look at or some kind of metric that says whether or not they're treating people in a way that's going to make them, when they leave prison, be less likely to reoffend?
Sure. The data that we were able to obtain shows a very spotty record. So, for example, the state prisons that are under contract with Arizona, the five private prisons that we have here, after three people escaped from a private prison here back in 2010, the Arizona Department of Corrections conducted a series of safety inspections, and the results were shocking. So in Kingman, this is the facility run by Management and Training Corporation from which the three prisoners escaped, they found that the alarm system had not been working for so long that the guards just ignored it, right? So the alarms would go off. They would prop the doors open with rocks. I'm not kidding. And so it is no surprise, right, that three people were able to basically walk right out. But the truly shocking thing is that then similar problems were found in a number of other facilities around the state of Arizona. And the one CCA prison that we were able to find inspection data from the state of California for found similar problems, malfunctioning cameras, alarm systems that just went without being fixed, one assumes because they didn't want to spend the money.
Amazing, amazing. Your bio sheet says that you're a former private prison inmate. Do you have a personal experience with this?
Does my bio sheet say that? No, I have not been.
Oh, you're not. Okay, somebody got it wrong.
But
then.
Some of my best friends are.
So you've known these people. So we're talking with Carolyn Isaac. She's the director of the American Friends Services Committee's Arizona program and author of this report on private prisons. Carolyn, we have just a minute left. What is the carry home message that you want people to hear, particularly our listeners in Arizona, but all over the country? I mean, this is happening. What should people do? What can people do if they want to oppose private prisons in their states?
Well, I think the first thing is for folks to know that really nobody's minding the store here. So wherever you live, people should be demanding of their government that at least they're looking into these facilities, finding out whether they are saving money, whether they are safe, whether they are providing quality services. And if they're not providing that information, people need to demand this, right? These are corporations that are performing a core government service, and they're doing it on our dime.
Yeah.
And they have a responsibility to let us look inside there.
Yeah. And I would say, just in the abstract, prisons should be part of the commons, which means that they should be owned as part of the commonwealth, which is by we the people, and not by a corporation that wants to make money for, you know, rich shareholders like Mitt Romney. Carolyn Isaac, AFSC.org, the American Friends Service Committee. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you very much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the privatization of America. It's amazing. What's next? They're going to privatize next.
I hear the train a-comin', it's rollin' around the bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rollin' on down to San Antonio.
Oh, I could listen to Johnny Cash for hours. In fact, I have listened to Johnny Cash for hours. My first job in radio, and at the time I thought, I hate country music. Why am I taking this job? Was as a country western DJ, and I was 16 years old. And I discovered that there's some really, really brilliant music out there. I've liked it by the rest of my life. I'm still an old rock and roller. But anyhow, Roxanne in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. What's up, Roxanne? Roxanne? Nope, I guess she's not there. Let's go to Mark in Waterloo, Iowa. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I was listening to your show, and you had previously talked about privatized prisons.
Yes, sir.
And I just wanted to see if you'd talk a little about, I mean, you have to believe that this would incentivize corrupt payoffs of judges to get increased sentences.
Well, there was that case in Pennsylvania last year where a local judge had sent a whole bunch of kids to a privately owned children's prison, and he was getting kickbacks, and he was sending them to jail for things like showing up at school with aspirin, you know, you're not supposed to have pills. He got busted. He's in jail now. But that's an example of the whole brand new layer of problems that you bring in when you say we're going to take what should be a state function and turn it into a for-profit industry.
Yeah, so. Those are the things that you just would have to expect, because the incentive is for them to make a profit, and if they can't fill those prison cells, then, you know, they have to do what they can. I'm sure, you know, payoffs and kickbacks would be commonplace, you know.
Yeah.
And with no regulation, it probably would be very easy to do, you'd imagine. So.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Thank you very much for the call. Bobby in Granbury, Texas. Hey, Bobby, what's up?
Hey, I got a problem with what you're talking about on automobile companies. The way a company raises money so that they can expand and buy capital equipment and so forth is to have bonds or to sell stock.
Typically, okay? Yeah.
We screwed all the people that had bonds. They ended up with zip. And the stockholders' shares are worth half of what they were. But the union folks got their money. And you're talking about having card check? We need card check like a black eye. We don't need card check.
So you're upset that the investors were hurt, but the workers were not. You think that the workers should have been hurt?
I think everybody should have gone bankrupt and started over.
So you think the workers
negotiated?
Negotiated
what their salary.
Bobby, I understand your position. I disagree with you. I think that when we allow,
are you a socialist?
Depends on how you define it. I would call myself a democratic socialist. Sure. I don't want the state.
You're not supposed to be in a communist, though, right?
No, I'm not a communist. I don't want the state owning my businesses. I don't want the state owning my business. Okay. I don't want the state manufacturing my car or my clothes. I don't. On the other hand, I think that if you have a major industry that it does affect the Commonwealth, it does affect the good of a large number of people, and it is in danger, and it's in a danger that from which it can recover, and the banking industry is incapable of helping it because it's been damaged by a decade of insane economic policies and deregulation, and, you know, ending Glass-Steagall and things, then you've got an obligation to step in.
Right. You said a decade. It's two decades.
Okay. I'd say it's three decades, really. I'd say it goes back to 82 when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act.
No, all the way back to Jimmy Carter is where it goes, if you're talking about the housing problem. And it just kept on being layered and postage stamped and patched and all the way through.
No, you're running on this Fox News myth that the whole thing crashed because Democrats said you must put poor people in homes.
I am a Democrat.
There is no law that says that. There is no law that said that. The Community Reinvestment Act said that you cannot redline any longer. You have to look at individuals and decide whether or not they're creditworthy based on their credit scores, period. You can't say somebody is not going to get a mortgage because of the neighborhood in which they live. That's all.
I'll tell you straight up, community banks in small towns, they didn't want people demonstrating in front of their banks.
Yeah.
And so all they had to do was follow the guidelines from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They followed those guidelines and made those loans. Then they turned around with them and sold them back to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and made their commission, went on about their business. The loans that they made, the people that they knew would pay, they kept. And that's the way it worked.
Yeah, and this is why Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac should never have been privatized. And it's why the Commodities Futures Modernization Act should not have been passed in 91, and Glass-Steagall shouldn't have been blown up with Graham-Leach-Bliley in 2000. It led directly to these things. And you can thank Phil Graham for that, whose wife Wendy was on the board of Enron, who got that deregulation through Congress. Because Enron wanted to make money by doing what these guys did with the mortgage industry with energy futures. And they did.
Well,
and a whole bunch of people made a whole bunch of money. Bobby, thanks for the call. Danny in Bluefield, West Virginia. Hey, Danny, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
Good.
I'm an energy executive. And if you want the straight scoop of what has been going on, I'll be glad to give it to you.
Okay, we got a minute. It's all yours.
I'll make it as quick as I can. I'll give you some information you're not aware of and that's never been released. The gentleman that called about Obama accusing the Bush administration of being in with the oil companies, actually it was Dick Cheney, if you remember the energy meeting he had where they kept out the environmentalists.
Right, in March of 2001, yeah.
Right, and the Lee Raymond of Exxon was ticked off that Americans were only paying $1.25 a gallon for fuel when Europeans were paying $7 a gallon, and he wanted something done about it. So they put a strategy in place that's still in effect to drive the price up to being the global level.
Right.
That's number one. Number two, here's the inside scoop. You remember when Dick Cheney shot the lawyer in Texas?
Yeah.
That took place on Catherine Armstrong's ranch. The Armstrong family Ann Armstrong was on the board of Halliburton. She's the one was responsible for hiring Dick Cheney to become the CEO of Halliburton. Tobin Armstrong, the father, was the biggest supporter of the Bush family. And as a matter of fact, he was the guy that brought Karl Rove to George Bush's attention.
Wow.
He spotted him while he was still at Texas University.
Amazing.
So the reason that they're not cracking down on commodities trading and the price is up because of the...
Hold on just a second, Bob.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
10 seconds to finish your question.
Okay, the reason the price is up on petroleum is that the big banks and the...
Sorry, we're out of time. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very saprostomously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good, Florida State Republicans. Last week, the Florida State Senate voted down the largest proposed expansion of private prisons in the country, despite the fact that the Republican Party has a 16-seat advantage in the Florida Senate. 9 Republicans joined 12 Democrats to defeat the prison privatization measure on a 21-19 vote. The main argument for the Republicans that joined the Democrats in the vote was that prison privatization would have adverse effects on state employees and would, quote, kick them under the bus, end quote. I often talk about the wave theory when it comes to conservatives, how they shift from radical right to a more moderate stance every generation or so. It would appear, despite being bribed left and right by the private prison industry, Florida Republicans have started to make this shift. And it's just in time to protect the citizens of Florida from the disastrous effects of prison privatization. The bad. CNN contributor Dana Loesch. This week, the Virginia State House moved closer to enacting a law which would require a woman to be forced to have a transvaginal ultrasound, a highly invasive procedure, before they could receive an abortion. The bill had been branded the state-sponsored rape bill because essentially the procedure involves forced penetration of a woman without her consent. Well, CNN's Dana Loesch has no problem with the controversial bill, arguing that the procedure is no different than consensual sex. Loesch said of women, they had no problem having similar to a transvaginal procedure when they engaged in the act that resulted in their pregnancy. Sorry, Dana, there is a big difference between a woman consenting to sex and the government forcing a highly invasive medical procedure on her. And the very, very ugly Minnesota state government. Governor Mark Dayton and the state legislature are intent on providing the Minnesota Vikings and NFL team with a new stadium. The catch? They want the citizens to pay for it. Minneapolis residents passed a referendum in 1997 requiring that voters must approve any state's plan to spend over $10 million on a sports facility. However, the state government is using loopholes to work around this and hitting the pockets of Minnesotans for $300 million in taxes. Nearly 70% of Minnesota voters thought that any new stadium should be built using private financing, according to a poll earlier this month. So despite a legal referendum and resounding public opposition, the state government is still intent on allowing the Vikings to fleece the people of Minnesota. The NFL and the Minnesota Vikings rake in millions of dollars every year, and the public is being forced to pay for their stadium? That is very, very ugly. Not unlike George Bush and the Texas Rangers. Yeah. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and Charlie in Masontown, West Virginia. Hey, Charlie, what's on your mind?
Hi there. I guess my question's about capitalism and the definition, and that it's characterized by open competition and free in the free market. And so my question's about why do we choose to bail out corporations if it's about competition?
Well, capitalism isn't about competition. Capitalism is thank you for the call, Charlie. Capitalism is an economic system whereby people can use capital, their own funds, money, to invest in businesses and make those businesses grow. There are a variety of alternatives. For example, communitarianism or I forget the word for it, but there's a system where people basically, you know, worker-owned co-ops. Which are growing like crazy. These are not capitalistic, but they're free enterprise. They're businesses out there, and they're growing all over the country, and they're a major part of a number of other countries. But the point is that capitalism can only exist if government puts in place a structure for it to exist. Capitalist companies use the court system, which we pay for. They use the laws, which we pay for, to put into place. Peter Barnes wrote this piece called How to Restore the Middle Class for Common Dreams. And he talks about how everybody in Alaska gets $1,000 to $2,000 a year from the oil revenues. So they're taking part of their commons and they're saying, okay, if you're going to use our commons, if you're going to use our oil, then you're going to pay for it. And he said, how about some non-labor income? He's talking about paying dividends to equity owners in good old-fashioned capitalist fashion. He says, consider the substantial contribution society makes to publicly traded stock values. When a company like Facebook or Google goes public, its value rises dramatically. Why? The extra value to the company derives from the fact the vastly enlarged market of investors who now trust a public company's financial statements because they're audited quarterly by the Securities and Exchange Commission, and they buy or sell their shares with a click of a mouse. Experts call this a liquidity premium, and it's generated not by the company but by society. This socially controlled wealth now flows mostly to a small number of Americans. He says if we wanted to, we could spread it around, charging corporations for the extra liquidity that society provides. He proposes that when a company goes public, 1% of their shares go into the American Permanent Fund for 10 years for a total of 10%, and that money be distributed back to the stockholders, to the shareholders, which would be we the people. I think it's a fascinating idea. He says the same thing. He says we give free airwaves to media companies and nearly perpetual or nearly global copyright protection to entertainment and software companies. These free gifts are worth big bucks. So let's monetize this stuff. Seems like a reasonable step. Wanda in Albuquerque, listening on KABQ. Hey, Wanda, what's up?
Well, since this is President's Day and since we just had a celebration of Martin Luther King Day, I've been wondering why women in the United States never seem to be honored for anything. Now, during the Revolutionary War, women were shipwrights, jailers, farriers, publishers, and all sorts of things. There was one young woman who managed to make indigo something that could be grown in the United States, and it became the most lucrative export of the southern states. And then when you look to amendments, I think it was 13 abolished slavery, 14 gave constitutional rights to blacks, the 15th gave voting rights to black men, but not black women, which really infuriated the suffragettes
right.
who've been working
it's
for
actually
abolition.
The 14th is the word that has the word male in it in regard to
is it?
In,
okay.
in regard to well, determination of congressional districts. But yes, you're right.
Anyway,
those three amendments, yeah.
And then I look at other countries that gave women the vote before we did. New Zealand, Australia, Canada, the UK for women over 30, which seems bizarre, but anyway,
yeah.
Russia, Czechoslovakia, and more. And then I'm looking at women now leading countries, past and present. There was Golda Meir and Indira Gandhi, and I think her name was Susan Clark of New Zealand, and Cory Aquino, and the present PM of Australia,
yeah.
Angela Merkel.
Michelle Bachelet down in Chile. Your point, Wanda, is that we need to have a national holiday celebrating women?
Yeah, and here's what I would suggest. This is quick. How about Dolly Madison, who stayed in the White House when the Brits were burning the place down, and she's rescuing documents in the picture of George Washington?
Yeah, Dolly Madison would make a fine,
She made excellent cupcakes also. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Wanda. Great to hear from you. Cora in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Cora, what's up?
Well, recently I heard that Bobby Kennedy and a group against Citizens United have asked Beau Biden of Delaware to revoke the charter of Massey Ferguson. And I wondered if you thought if more states did this against these egregious companies, whether this would be a good pushback.
I do. And the problem is that states are reluctant to do this, A, because many of their own state legislators are owned by those companies, in large part because of rulings like the Citizens United, and B, because when you shut down a company, you also lose tax revenue. So, but I am totally with the effort to say, hey, a corporation that is not serving in the public good does not deserve to exist and certainly doesn't deserve to have all the special treatment that you get as a corporation that you can't get as an individual. Cora, thank you very much for bringing that issue up. Michael in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Michael. Thanks for listening to WSTE. What's up?
I would like to ask your opinion about the American Legislation Exchange Council. How they push laws to Alec, how they push laws for for-profit prison systems and things like that. And also that on February 29th, Occupy Scranton is trying to have a protest against Alec. And also in Portland, they're pushing for it. And if you search at F29 on Twitter or go to shutdownthecorporations.org or OccupyScrantonPA.org. And then so to get that out, and then I just like to know what you think.
I think it's a great idea, and good on you for you know, and everybody there at Scranton, Occupy Scranton, and please give them all my very best regards. I'm totally with it, and totally behind it.
You mentioned the Kids for Cash, like the, and that's actually happened in Scranton.
Yeah.
The judges got $2.6 million in bribes.
Yep.
And it was from a private child thing that they were taking advantage of kids.
Yeah, it was a for-profit prison.
Yep,
absolutely. Thank you very much for the call, Michael. Good to hear from you. Kevin in Deerfield. Kevin, we got just a minute left. A quick one?
Tom, I think the problem we have is representation in this country. If we go back to 1911 levels, you're talking about 2,300 senators and 10,000 representatives.
Yes,
and
I think the earlier caller pointed that out.
Number, it'd be a huge dilution in the value of a dollar buying an election.
Yes, I agree. I think that there's tremendous benefits that would come out of that, of expanding the size of our legislature. Just absolutely tremendous benefits. It would make the whole process more small-D democratic. But like I said, they'd have to build a whole brand-new Capitol building. It would certainly change the dynamics, but which is not impossible to do. If you can put 10,000 people in a room to watch a hockey game, you can put 10,000 people in a state capitol or a federal capitol in Washington, D.C. But the more I think about it, the more it appeals to me. So thank you very much, Kevin, for adding to the discussion. Fascinating idea. And I mean, we could just start out by just doubling the number of representatives we have. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Should we have an American permanent fund that pays dividends to all Americans? I think that's a pretty cool idea. Works for Alaska.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back, Jim, in Detroit. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind? It says here you want to disagree with me.
Yeah, hey, Tom, there's a number of fallacies in your ideological views that it would take a long time to dissect. I'll just dissect a couple of them. Number one, that you're empowering government with vast tax and regulatory power that it covers trillions of dollars is a ticket for corruption. And essentially what happens when government controls all this money through taxes and regulation is that the corrupt, inefficient, and wasteful actors in society, they go to government to get favors in order to avoid competition.
So what you're saying is that the for-profit corrupt industries will exploit government.
Well, the for-profit, the ones that are profitable don't need to exploit government because...
Well, ExxonMobil is profitable, they've bought off enough legislators that they're getting government to give them billions of dollars a year, and they're paying nothing in taxes. You know, GE is profitable. They bought off enough legislators to do that. I don't disagree that government, when it is under the sway of big money from large corporate interests, is corrupted. I'm absolutely with you on that, and I think it needs to be stopped. And it's a doctrine that has been fought against all the way back 1907, the Tillman Act, passed under Republican Teddy Roosevelt, saying that no corporation can give any money to any politician or political party for to influence their behavior in any way. It should be illegal. That law was blown up by the Supreme Court in 2010 in the Citizens United decision in January 2010. And so now we have the official corruption. But the thing that you're missing is that government is us. The first three words of the Constitution, we the people. Government is us. And private corporations are looking out for their stockholders exclusively. Government, if it's functioning right and when it's functioning right, and I'll grant you ours isn't, but when it's not corrupted by big money, it is us. It works on our behalf. That's a good and desirable thing. It's what the founders fought and died for.
Tom, you're completely missing the point. You're mistaking the cause for the symptom. If government didn't have all this tax and the regulatory power, then corporations couldn't go to them for favors. Where would they go? They'd have
they would screw you and they would screw me.
Tom, you know, you let people talk or you just cut them off.
You asked a question, I gave you the answer.
No, what I'm telling you is that we have two choices. We can either vote every time we step out of the house and vote for the corporations we want by consumer preferences. And we get 100% satisfied every time. If companies don't satisfy those preferences, then they go out of business. They're not bailed out. Number two, if we do it your way, then we get to vote once for the lesser two evils every 2, 4, 6 years. And when 50% of the people are satisfied with the lesser two evils, we put them in office, they get more and more power and nothing changes.
Okay, Jim, your rant is wandering into the realm of filibuster. Let me just ask a really simple question. In most European countries, you can get 100 megabit download, 10 megabit upload internet service, plus over 100 channels of cable TV, plus unlimited cell phone use for about $45 to $50 a month. In the U.S., that same product would cost around $250 a month. The reason why in Europe it's so much cheaper is because the European governments passed regulations that say if you own wire or wireless that is in any way part of using the commons, in other words, if we're maintaining the right of way through our road system, or if it is, you know, part of the over the air, then that's the commons, and you have to allow any company to pay you a reasonable price, but to also use your system. So they have competition. The government created competition. Here in the United States, the government has done the opposite. It has. But when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, we got anti-competition, and now we have giant monopolies, and you have one or two cable companies or phone companies that you can choose from, and you're paying absurd amounts of money. Which is better?
What is better? What happened in Europe is that their bankrupt up to their eyeballs.
This has got nothing to do with the World Bank.
Those prices are based on political expediency rather than economic
reality. They are absolutely not. Those prices are based on competition.
No, it's not. The governments in Europe, which, by the way, are bankrupt and have had anemic growth since the World War II compared to the United States. And we're headed that way. Because
Jim, you need to visit Europe.
Control the market.
You need to visit Europe, man. You just don't know what you're talking about. That's incredible. Greg in Oregon City, Oregon. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I heard you bring up today on a couple of occasions, maybe three times, the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend.
Yeah.
And I happen to know a little bit about that. I lived most of my life up there. I was there when that went through. And what
79?
I wanted to clarify for – what's that?
Is it 79?
76.
76, okay.
Yeah. But what I wanted to clarify for everyone up there was that because you mentioned Sarah Palin in conjunction with that as if she was some sort of a administrator of the fund or had something to do with it.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is she would have been about 12 years old at the time that went through.
Sure.
The governor, Jay Hammond, is the one that was the visionary there.
Right. No, but the governor, and every year when they write the checks, the governors love to say, here, have some money.
They have no choice. They have no choice. They're just a functionary because the thing was done through a constitutional amendment at that time.
By referendum?
Jay Hammond was a great governor. He was a visionary.
Done by referendum or was it done by legislative action?
It was done by legislative action. The governor has no control over that at all.
Yeah.
It would have to be a constitutional amendment. I just wanted to say that because you're right. You're very right that it's a very important thing for people to be able to at least share in the plundering of a resource.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when they live there. But I don't want Sarah Palin's name to be attached to anything positive in the state of Alaska because in her half term as governor, she did the sum total of nothing.
Yeah, and here's what the Simpsons had to say about that.
Welcome to Alaska. Here's $1,000.
Well, it's about time. But why?
We pay every resident $1,000 to allow the oil companies to ravage our state's natural beauty.
There you go. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.